Lecture 14, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persom, October 12, 2006.
Okay, let's get started. So I want to apologize for yesterday. There was this International Institute for Nanotechnology Symposium. I was supposed to speak at 11:30 and therefore be done at 12:15. This first session ran 45 minutes late, which then put me at 12:15 to 1. I was still going to run over here and teach. Then they decided to cancel or delay my talk till after lunch, which would have put me right in the middle of class. Therefore, class was canceled. And then they delayed me to 2 o'clock. So I could have taught anyway, but this was beyond my control, unfortunately. The good news is that what we have to cover for homework number 3 and therefore the exam, we should easily be able to do in class today and tomorrow. And so we'll be where we need to be by the end of the week. Also, as you know, yesterday office hours were canceled. They'll be today, 2 to 4. I understand some of you have class until 3:20. If you come at 3:20 or 3:30 and we need to go a little past 4, that's fine. I will do that. So just come as soon as you can and we'll address whatever questions you have. Okay, so with that said, let's get back to variational principle. And what we were considering last time and begun the analysis of was helium. So we want to try some atom more complicated than hydrogen and demonstrate the utility of the variational principle in 3 dimensions. Recall, helium has 2 electrons, 2 protons, 2 neutrons, and has the following Hamiltonian. Kinetic energy for each electron . Then we have 3 electrostatic terms. 2 of them are attraction of each electron with a nucleus. The nucleus has a charge of 2 in this case. And then a repulsive term between the electrons, which is given by this distance between them, which is the magnitude of R1 minus R2. And actually, last time we came up with an expression for this using the law of cosine, so we'll employ that in a minute. The first thing we said was, let's just ignore the electron-electron interaction. In that case, this Hamiltonian can be split using separation of variables, where we have the 2 variables R1 vector and R2 vector. When you do that, you'll get 2 hydrogen-like wave functions, the only difference being that the charge in the nucleus is twice the charge that you find in the hydrogen atom. And as a result, without doing any math, we can see that the ground state wave function in the absence of the electron-electron interaction would be equal to a product of the ground state wave functions of the hydrogen-like atoms. And we know those ground states are n equal to 1, L equal to 0, M equal to 0, so psi 1, 0, 0. This will be equal to 8 over pi a cubed. If you recall, in the case of the hydrogen atom, is just 1 over pi a cubed. But in this case, because of the charge 2, the Bohr radius gets decreased by a factor of 2. So a over 2 cubed gives you a factor of 8 in the numerator. Also, in the exponent, instead of having r over a, we have r over a over 2, which would be 2 r over a. And of course, we have 2 contributions because we have 2 electrons. So we're going to sum these together in the exponent. Multiplying exponents leads to summing them. And so we get this ground state wave function. Furthermore, as we talked about now several times, the ground state energy would be 8 times the ground state energy of the hydrogen atom. So this would be 8 times negative 13.6 eV, which is negative 109 eV. We get a factor 4 due to the fact that we have a factor z squared, which would be 2 squared in this case, due to the fact that there's charge 2 in the nucleus. Then we multiply by another factor of 2 because there are 2 electrons. So we get a factor 8 here as well. But experimentally, it is known that the ground state energy is negative 79 electron volts. And so obviously, the electron-electron interaction is important and needs to be addressed. And as a result, the first thing we were going to try to do was utilize the real Hamiltonian, but try as a trial wave function the variational principle this psi naught in the absence of electron-electron interaction. So that's what we started to do last time. So what we're going to do to account for the electron-electron repulsion we'll try the variational principle. Using psi naught as the trial wave function. Okay. Now this problem is perfect for variational principle because we know what the answer is. So we can try any wave function, see how close we get. If it doesn't give us an answer we're satisfied with, we'll add a new parameter and then try to minimize the Hamiltonian with that new parameter or with respect to that new parameter and hopefully get closer to the known result. Question?
What other parameters do you consider?
The parameter we'll do in this case is clearly what is not physical here is that each electron would see the full charge of the nucleus. So if you think about this, there's two electrons. So presumably one of the electrons is screening the nuclear charge. And so the effective charge of the nucleus has got to be something less than 2. So instead of having 2, which we've assumed here, we'll make it some value z. Then we'll solve the problem again using that value for that value of z, minimize with respect to z to determine what the minimum value of the Hamiltonian is for a particular value of z. That value z should be less than 2, obviously due to screening. We'll take that minimized value of z, plug it into the Hamiltonian, and hopefully get a number which is closer to the real result. In an arbitrary problem, you'd have to decide what is the critical parameter. And you'd have to think about the physics of the situation. Here, it makes sense intuitively or physically that there'd be shielding of the nuclear charge. And that's what will make the free parameter. But you'll find, in general, that you can add as many parameters as you want. It becomes a multivariable minimization problem. And if you've chosen good variables, you'll get closer to the real answer.
If you choose a wrong one, will you find that you just get a nonsensical answer?
Remember, the variational principle will always give you an answer. It's an upper bound. If you pick a wave function which is nowhere near reality, you could be 100 electron volts greater than the ground state energy. All you know is the ground state energy is less than that value. And that's the real drawback of variational principles. You don't know how close you are to the real answer unless you know what the real answer is. So it's not the best approach in many cases. But in chemistry, you often know some things. Like you can measure this. And if you can determine a good trial wave function to determine this, then you could calculate other parameters, which may be more difficult to measure. And that's the general approach taken in quantum chemistry. And there are fancier ways of doing this nowadays, like density functional theory. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about band structure in solids. Okay. See, I think it's clear what the strengths and weaknesses of this approach are. Strength is it's very easy to do. Weakness is that you never know how close you are to reality, unless you know what reality is. Okay. So, I would say it's not a good predictive tool, but it's a good tool for matching theory or matching experiment. Okay, so we're going to try variational principle. What do? We take the real Hamiltonian and have it operate on our trial wave function. The real Hamiltonian is equal to the Hamiltonian of these hydrogen-like atoms, that is, without electron-electron interaction, plus the electron-electron interaction. We know that the stationary state energies for everything but the electron-electron interaction is 8E1, and so the Hamiltonian operating on psi naught will be 8E1 plus this repulsive term times psi naught. And as a result, what we want to seek, which is the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, will just be equal to 8E1 plus the expectation value of the electron-electron repulsion. So we boil the problem down to determining the expectation value of the electron-electron repulsion using a trial wave function. And so we boil this down to one integral. It's a complicated integral. It's a six-fold integral, but it's one integral. And so we'll do it. The electron-electron repulsion is, of course, e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught times 1 over r1 minus r2. In addition, we're going to get psi naught squared, because we're taking the expectation value. So psi naught squared will be 8 over pi a cubed quantity squared. That's a constant, so we pull out in front of the integral. Everything else is a function of R1 and R2, so it goes inside the integral. Magnitude squared of psi naught will be e to the negative 4 R1 plus R2 over A, divided by R1 minus R2 magnitude. That's the repulsive term. And of course, we're integrating this over both electrons, three spatial coordinates. So it's a six-fold integral. This is what we have to evaluate. And so we'll do this. What I showed you last time is that we can use law of cosines to determine this value. So from law of cosines, we know that R1 minus R2 is equal to the square root of R1 squared plus R2 squared minus R1 R2. Theta 2 is the angle between R1 and R2. And we've chosen R1 to be along the z-axis for the second electron. And as a result, that angle is just theta sub 2. So that was an appropriately chosen coordinate system to make the math simple, relatively simple. So we have to do this six-fold integral. Let's do the three-fold integral for R2 first, and then we'll do R1. So we'll perform the R2 integral first. I'm going to call that I2. I2 will be equal to the integral of e to the negative 4 R2 over A divided by R1 minus R2 times this volume element for the second electron. Let's write this now using law of cosines. So I2 will be equal to an integral of e to the negative 4 R2 over A. Law of cosines tells us that the denominator becomes R1 squared plus R2 squared minus 2 R1 R2 cosine theta sub 2. Now we're going to put in the differential volume element for R2, which is in spherical coordinates R2 squared sine theta 2 dr2 d theta 2 d phi 2. You can see that the integrand has no phi dependence, and so the phi integral is trivial. Phi is integrated from 0 to 2 pi. And so the phi 2 integral is just 2 pi. The theta 2 integral, which we'll do next, is of course the integral from 0 to pi of sine theta 2 over R1 squared plus R2 squared minus 2 R1 R2 cosine theta sub 2 d theta sub 2. This is a case where this sine theta 2 comes in very handy because we could define a new variable u, which is R1 squared plus R2 squared minus 2 R1 R2 cosine theta 2. Du is then just going to be equal to the derivative of cosine, which is sine, and as a result, we have in the denominator that term already present. And as a result, this just becomes an integral of 1 over square root of u, which is just going to be equal to square root, or proportional to the square root of u. If we go ahead and execute that integral, what we get is R1 squared plus R2 squared minus 2 R1 R2 cosine theta sub 2 divided by R1 R2 evaluated from 0 to pi. Okay. Now, as a result, if we evaluate this at the two bounds, we get 1 over R1 R2 square root of R1 squared plus R2 squared plus 2 R1 R2, because cosine of pi is negative 1, minus square root of R1 squared plus R2 squared minus 2 R1 R2. Cosine of 0 is 1. And this is convenient because you'll notice perhaps from your high school algebra that R1 squared plus 2 R1 R2 plus R2 squared is just equal to R1 plus R2 squared. And the second term is just R1 minus R2 squared. So the square root of R1 plus R2 squared is just R1 plus R2. This will be equal to 1 over R1 times R2 times R1 plus R2 minus, now in this case it matters which is bigger, R1 or R2. And so we can deal with that by just taking the absolute value of the difference. And as a result, we can now consider two cases, one case where R1 is greater than R2 and the other case where R2 is greater than R1. And this will be therefore equal to 2 over R1 if R2 is less than R1. If R2 is less than R1, then the absolute value of R1 minus R2 is just R1 minus R2. As a result, the R1s will cancel, and you'll get 2 R2. 2 R2 divided by R1 over R2 is just 2 over R1. Similarly, you'll get 2 over R2 if R2 is greater than R1. And so it looks like a messy integral, but boils down to a simple result. Okay. Now that we have the R2 integral done, we have to go back to the R1 integral. We still have three more integrals left. Oh, sorry, we have one more thing we have to do with I2. We didn't do the R2 integral yet. So we're going to take the result of the theta 2 integral, plug it into this integrand, and then evaluate the R2 integral. So I2 is now equal to 4 pi. So we get a factor of 2 pi from the phi 2 integral and a factor of 2 here. So it's 4 pi times, now we have to split the R2 integral up into two integrals because we have two different regions for R2 space. One where R2 is less than R1 and where R2 is greater than R1. So the first integral will be an integral from 0 to R1, in which case we use 2 over R1. We can pull the R1 out in front because it's independent of R2. The integrand is now e to the negative 4 R2 over A, R2 squared dR2, plus an integral from R1 to infinity, which is the second term here. This is a function of R2, so it stays inside of the integral. It will be equal to e to the negative 4 R2 over A. Now it's just R2, because we had R2 squared divided by R2, so it's R2 to the first power dR2. Okay. These integrals we've done earlier in the course. They're known. You could look them up or evaluate them. I'm just going to write down the result. If you went ahead and executed these two integrals, what you would get out is pi a cubed over 8 R1. Times the quantity 1 minus the quantity 1 plus 2 R1 over A, e to the negative 4 R1 over A. Now we're finally done with the I2 integral. We now have to plug this back in and evaluate the R1 vector integral. So we'll do that. So this expectation value, the electron-electron repulsion, is equal to e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught, 8 over pi a cubed, an integral with our new integrand, which is 1 minus 1 plus 2 R1 over A, e to the negative 4 R1 over A, e to the negative 4 R1 over A, which was present earlier in the first integral we wrote down. That goes back in, times the volume element, which is R1 sine theta 1, dr1, d theta 1, d phi 1, where this is just R1 to the first, because we have a 1 over R1 term here, and this would normally be R1 squared. Okay? So we have three integrals left. Fortunately, we see that the integrand is independent of theta and phi, and so the angular integrals are trivial and are just equal to 4 pi, because there's 4 pi steradians in angular space. The R1 integral is all that is left, and the R1 integral is an integral now. R1 goes from 0 to infinity of R1 e to the negative 4 R1 over A minus the quantity R1 plus 2 R1 squared over A e to the negative 8 R1 over A dR1. These integrals are also ones we've done earlier in the course. They're known. We're just going to go ahead and evaluate them and find that this definite integral is equal to 5a squared over 128. So you can see what I'm trying to do here is take you through the solution, but not take you through every single gory detail of evaluating these integrals since we've done them before. We now know everything. We know the angular integrals are 4 pi. We know the R1 integral is 5a squared over 128. We simply plug them back in, and we find that the expectation value of the electron-electron repulsion is equal to 5 over 4a e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught. Of course, we can rewrite this now in terms of the ground state energy of the hydrogen atom. And this is equal to negative 5/2 times E1. E1 is negative 13.6 EV. And as a result, the electron-electron repulsion is approximately equal to 34 electron volts. So now we're done. We've now determined a new value, at least using variational principle, a new guess for what the ground state energy should be, or an upper bound for the ground state energy should be. In particular, the Hamiltonian, we said, was equal to negative 109 eV plus the expectation value of the electron-electron repulsion, which we know is 34 eV. This is equal to negative 75 eV. Remember, the experimental value is negative 79 eV. The result of the variational principle better be greater than the real value, and it is. It's 4 electron volts higher than the real value. It's a lot closer than we were before. Before we were off by 30 electron volts, now we're only off by 4 electron volts. So see, the variational principle has done a pretty good job. But we can do better. 4 electron volts is still a lot of energy. And so to do better, we're going to now introduce this parameter Z, an effective nuclear charge, which we would expect to be less than 2 due to screening from the other electron. Before we do that, is everybody comfortable with how we got to negative 75 EV? Okay. Like I said, variational principle is conceptually trivial. The math can be more or less dicey depending upon how many integrals you have to do and what those integrals are. But all that we've done here is carefully chosen coordinate system and executed a six-fold integral. There's nothing else more complicated here in terms of the physics. And we see that it does a good job. So this is close, or this is closer to experiment. But we can do better. And so what we're going to do, as I've said, is introduce a new value for the nuclear charge, which will include this electron-electron, or the electron screening, which occurs. Okay? So we want to include screening of the nuclear charge. By introducing a new parameter, Z. We'll evaluate the expectation value of the Hamiltonian with this new parameter, Z. We'll then minimize it with respect to Z to determine what Z is minimized. It should be less than 2. We'll then plug that minimized value of Z in to determine the minimized value of the Hamiltonian. And we're hoping that it's going to get us closer to the real value. That's the approach. So this implies a new trial wave function. The new trial wave function I'm going to call psi sub 1. It's going to be almost identical to the one we used before, except now we're going to have this new nuclear charge Z. And as a result, This will become z cubed over pi a cubed. Remember, before we assumed the nuclear charge was 2, and so we had 2 cubed, which was 8. So basically, we're going in and multiplying everything, or multiplying a by 2 over z. That's, of course, cubed here, so we're going to get z cubed in the numerator. The exponent will now become negative z, because it's z instead of 2, r1 plus r2 over a. So this is our new trial wave function. Now, this is a point which will catch some people, I'm sure, and that is, in variational principle, although the wave function is going to be approximated with some new parameter z, the Hamiltonian is still the real Hamiltonian. And so we're not going to change the Hamiltonian. It's the same Hamiltonian as before. The nuclear charge is really 2. It's not something less than 2. And as a result, what I'm going to do is write the helium Hamiltonian. It's the same as before, but in a new suggestive form to make the evaluation of the expectation value of the Hamiltonian easier. So the Hamiltonian for the helium atom is still the kinetic energy, which we know is 2 Laplacians. Then we're going to have the potential energy. And I'm going to write the potential energy in the following way. Minus e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught, z over r1 plus z over r2 plus e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught, z minus 2 over r1 plus z minus 2 over r2 plus 1 over r1 minus r2. Okay. So if we were to add this term to that term, what we get is negative z plus z minus 2, which would just be negative 2, and that's the real Hamiltonian. The reason I've written it in this way is that this term plus this term, if we take the expectation value of the Hamiltonian with this new trial wave function, will give us back a hydrogen-like solution. And as a result, we'll get a new hydrogen-like ground state energy, but with a new nuclear charge, z. Then we're going to have to determine two new expectation value terms. One will be an expectation value of 1 over r1, 1 over r2, and the same term we had before, the electron-electron repulsion. Okay. Is everybody comfortable with this question?
Where does that z minus 2 come from? Where does the 2 come from?
Okay. So remember when we first wrote on the Hamiltonian for the helium atom, that's always going to be the same. And that has three major terms in it. One is the kinetic energy. The second is the attractive term between each electron and the nucleus of the charge 2. Okay? And then the final term is the electron-electron repulsion. So this term plus that term is just negative 2 e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught r1. Similarly, this is the r2 term. I've just written it in this way because when we take the expectation value of the Hamiltonian with this new trial wave function, this is trivial because it's just a hydrogen-like solution with a new nuclear charge z. So we already know what that answer is. And that means we've boiled it down to evaluating three integrals, if you will. But these two integrals are identical to one another. And as a result, we've boiled down to evaluating two integrals. That's why I've written it in this way. Yeah?
Sorry, I lost you when you said, like, why are you using z cubed? Why isn't it like 2z squared?
Here?
Yeah.
We're saying that what we have now, or what we're assuming we have, is that each electron sees a shielded nuclear charge, z. And so this is just like a hydrogen atom, except the nuclear charge is z as opposed to 1. And what that implies is the Bohr radius, if you were to redo the hydrogen atom with a new nuclear charge z, the Bohr radius becomes a over z. In the case of helium, z was 2, and so it became a over 2. So if you have a over 2 in the denominator and you cube it, you get 8 in the numerator. Similarly, if you have a over 2 in the denominator here, you get 2 over a. That's what we saw before for our initial trial wave function. Now instead of 2, we have z, so everywhere we had a 2 becomes z. So 2 cubed becomes z cubed. 2 over a becomes z over a. Yep. So this is why it's confusing, because the trial wave function, we're assuming that there's this shielding occurring, but the Hamiltonian is this. It is this, period. The shielding is taken into account through this repulsive interaction. Our trial wave function, of course, we're guessing without including the repulsive interaction. That's the whole point of the variational principle, is you're trying to get a guess a good guess for the ground state wave function through an appropriately chosen wave function. Okay. So, if everybody's okay with this, all we have to do is simply evaluate the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. And when I write it in this way, we've made our life easier because we already know this expectation value of this Hamiltonian with this wave function. And in particular, it's going to be equal to z squared times E1. And of course, it'll be times 2 because we have 2 electrons. So that's the first two terms. Plus, we're going to have 2 terms which go with z minus 2 over R1. The R1 and R2 are independent of one another, so those two integrals will be identical. And in particular, we'll get now 2, because there are 2 electrons, times z minus 2, which are these constants, times the expectation value of 1 over r. So we have to do this integral, the expectation value of 1 over r, plus the expectation value of the electron-electron interaction. And of course, we're going to take these expectation values using our new trial wave function. Okay. Now, the expectation value of 1 over r is already determined. It's determined in problem 6.12 of Griffiths. You need it when you're calculating the fine structure of hydrogen, which we will not be doing in this class, but if you want to read about it, you know, be my guest. After we do perturbation theory, you'll understand how you could solve the fine structure of hydrogen. Remember, this is just an integral. You could evaluate it, but I don't want to spend time in class doing it. So you can see problem 6.12 or just do the integral if you want. But you'll find the expectation value of 1 over r for a hydrogen-like wave function with nuclear charge z is equal to z over a. Okay. This should make some sense to you because the most likely position to find the electron in the hydrogen atom is at the Bohr radius. The Bohr radius, in the presence of a different nuclear charge, z becomes a over z. So the expectation value of 1 over r, we would have guessed to be z over a. So it actually makes sense physically. But you'd actually have to do the math to be fully convinced of it. But if you'll take my word for it, you can just accept this or go home and try it for yourself. The expectation value of the electron-electron repulsion is exactly the same as before, because this term is the same. The only thing which has changed is we've changed 2 to z. So it's the same as before, except now we want arbitrary nuclear charge z. Instead of z equal to 2. And so all we do is we go back to the solution we already found and replace what had been a over 2 with a over z. So we already know, I'm about to erase it, we already know what it is right here. So we're just going to replace a over 2 with a over z. Because we've already done the six-fold integral, we're just making a variable change from nuclear charge 2 to nuclear charge z. So we don't have to redo all this math. Incidentally, that's what you'll be doing in the homework. You'll be considering two cases. One is the negatively charged hydrogen ion, which has a nuclear charge of 1, but 2 electrons, just like the helium atom. And then you'll consider the case of positively charged lithium, which has 2 electrons and a nuclear charge of 3. So you get to redo this analysis twice in the homework. And I'd recommend you do it this way, because you really don't have to do any new math. You just have to recognize the variable change that we're making. So if we wanted now interested in the value of z, instead of z equal to 2, we multiply a by 2 over z. And as a result, the expectation value of the electron-electron repulsion is just 5z over 8a. Times e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught. And this is just equal to negative 5z over 4 times e1. Okay? And as a result, the expectation of the value of the Hamiltonian we see is equal to the first term we already found is 2z squared over e1. The second term is plus 2 z1 minus z2, or sorry, 2 times quantity z minus 2 times the expectation value of 1 over r, which I said you could calculate to be z over a. And in addition, we're going to have the term e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught, which I'm sorry, I forgot to include in the Hamiltonian term there, but that's obviously present because it's a constant out in front, minus the expectation value of the electron-electron repulsion, which is 5/4 z times e1. Now we're going to recognize that this term here, z e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught a, is just equal to negative 2 z times e1. And as a result, the expectation value of the Hamiltonian is just equal to 2 z squared minus 4 z, z minus 2, minus 5/4 z times e1. If we went ahead and multiplied this through, we get 2z squared minus 4z squared, which is just negative 2z squared. So this is equal to negative 2z squared. We would then get 8z squared minus 5/4 z, which is equal to 27/4 z times e1. So this is our new expectation value of the Hamiltonian. What we're going to do is minimize this with respect to z. Okay. So minimize the Hamiltonian, which means you take the derivative. The derivative here is easy because we just have a polynomial. The derivative will be equal to negative 4z plus 27/4 times e1. And when you're trying to find the minimum, you set the derivative equal to 0. And as a result, we can solve for z, and z is equal to 27/16, which is 1.69. And so as expected, the nuclear charge is screened by the other electron and has some value less than 2, and it's 1.69. We then plug this value, plug z equal to 27/16 into h, and that yields the minimum value of the Hamiltonian with this free z. It will be equal to negative 2z squared. Z is 27/16 squared plus 27/4 times 27/16. Times E1, which is negative 13.6 EV, and what we get out is negative 77.5 EV. So before, when we did not include the screening, we got negative 75, and the real answer is negative 79. By including screening, we've now got it to within 1.5 electron volts of the real ground state energy. And of course, if you were still not satisfied, you could introduce more parameters and keep making more and more complicated trial wave functions until you found one which got you as close as you wanted to get to the ground state energy of helium. And that's the game. If you're a quantum chemist, you come up with more and more complex trial wave functions until you've minimized the difference between the variational principle answer and the real answer. Okay? Question?
What would be an example of the next parameter you'd introduce in this case?
Oh, you have to be clever here. Griffiths, in his book, is kind of funny about it. He says at this point, he loses interest in the problem. And you'd have to go to a quantum chemistry textbook and see if there's a textbook example of how this is done. Realistically, nowadays, it's all done computationally using techniques like density functional theory, which we'll cover later on in the course in more detail. But to do it analytically, which is, of course, all we're doing in class, I'm not sure how you can move forward at this point. Any other questions on variational principle? Okay. So as I said, conceptually it's quite simple. You have to be a little clever though in choosing your trial wave functions and recognizing how that influences the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. Everything else is just math. But if you choose your trial wave function cleverly and you construct your Hamiltonian cleverly, the math can be made much more simple. And that is, of course, what I would recommend that you do in the homework. You really shouldn't have to do much math at all in that problem if you follow this solution. Okay. Any final questions on the variational principle? If not, as we've already alluded to earlier today, variational principle has these fundamental flaws. Probably the number one fundamental flaw is that while you get an upper bound for the ground state energy, you don't know if that upper bound is within an electron volt, a millielectron volt, or a kilo electron volt. And as a result, you really don't know how good you are or how good your trial wave function is. Furthermore, even if your trial wave function gives you a good value, that doesn't guarantee that it is in any way related to the real wave function. Because the variational principle does not calculate wave functions. It just calculates energies. In addition, if you want to find any excited state energy, in most cases, the variational principle will also not work for you. It works well for the ground state energy, but not very well for excited state energies. So there are these three fundamental problems with variational principle, which will motivate us to look for other approximation strategies. And this is a course in and of itself, how to approximate the Schrodinger equation. I'm going to tell you one more class of approximation methods. If you're interested in more, the rest of Griffiths covers more examples like the WKB approximation, which is particularly useful for calculating tunneling probabilities or triangular potentials, which we haven't talked about in this course. Another approach which is quite useful, but we don't have time to cover, is so-called time-dependent perturbation theory and also degenerate perturbation theory. We're just going to do time-independent non-degenerate perturbation theory. These other forms of perturbation theory are important if you have a time-dependent potential, obviously, particularly useful if you want to study things like how light interacts with matter. So in 451, if you take that course, we'll go through time-dependent perturbation theory at that point so you can understand things like spontaneous emission and stimulated emission of radiation from matter. These are Einstein equations. Degenerate perturbation theory is important when you have a stationary state solution which has degeneracy. And that's quite important for many three-dimensional potentials, like the hydrogen atom obviously had degeneracy in all of its excited states. And as well, degenerate perturbation theory is useful, but conceptually it's not much different than what we're doing for non-degenerate. So given our time constraints, we're just going to cover non-degenerate perturbation theory. So let me introduce it, and tomorrow we'll finish it off. Non-degenerate. Time independent, perturbation theory. And I'll point out where the degeneracy becomes a problem and how you might address it, although we're not going to do it explicitly in this course. You will not be responsible for it. And the time-dependent case is clearly important for time-dependent potentials, and we've considered none thus far in this course, and so that's why we're not going to cover it. Okay, so let's talk about non-degenerate time-independent perturbation theory. Suppose we know the stationary states or stationary state solutions to the Schrodinger equation for some potential. For example, let's say we do know the stationary state solutions to the particle in a box, or the 1D infinite potential well problem. So we're saying that we know some Hamiltonian, that in this case I'm assuming it's the infinite potential well problem. And we know the stationary state wave functions. If we had that Hamiltonian operating on stationary state wave functions, we know the Schrodinger equation would give us back the stationary state energies times those stationary state wave functions. So we're assuming we know this for some Hamiltonian. Now, we perturb the potential slightly. Okay. I.e., the new Hamiltonian H will be equal to the original Hamiltonian that we knew plus some perturbation. The perturbation is H prime, and I'm labeling it with this term lambda. Lambda is just a parameter which allows us to keep track of what order we're going to evaluate the perturbated form of the solution. And there's therefore first order, second order, third order, nth order perturbation theory. Depending upon what problem you're solving, you'll have to decide how many orders you need to get a realistic answer. And in practice, it's usually first or second order perturbation theory that's sufficient. So let's say we had this particle in a box and then we added a blip in the potential of some type. What is the new energy? Or what are the new energies and what are the new stationary state wave functions? That's what perturbation theory will give us. This is an extremely powerful technique because you can imagine many cases. For example, a hydrogen atom. If you put a hydrogen atom in an electric field, what happens? You're going to get a new, the potential or the Hamiltonian will be exactly the same, except now you have some new term which is related to the charge times the electric field times some distance parameter. You can, instead of resolving the entire problem, utilize the result that we know and this small perturbation to calculate what the perturbation will be to the ground state energies and ground state wave function. So from that, for example, you can calculate the polarizability of a hydrogen atom. Okay. So that's the setup. What we want to find are the new solutions. Which would be the real Hamiltonian H times the real wave function psi n will be equal to some new stationary state energy n times psi n. That's what we want to find. And of course what we're doing is attempting to approximate the solution to this problem. We don't want to solve it exactly because it's assumed that it's not possible in this case. So we will approximate these solutions by building on what we know. So we'll be building on the known solutions to the unperturbed case. So we know this, and the question is, what is that? So we want to build on what we know. To begin, we will write or expand psi n and en as power series in lambda. Remember, lambda is just a means of keeping track of what order we're going to evaluate the theory. So the power series for psi n will be equal to the zeroth order term, which is just psi n naught, plus lambda to the first psi n 1 plus lambda squared psi n 2, etc. So this will be the first order correction, second order correction. En will be equal to en naught plus lambda en 1 plus lambda squared en 2, etc. This is obviously the first order correction to the energy and the second order correction to the energy. So what we're going to do is take these power series, plug them into the real Schrodinger equation with the real Hamiltonian, which includes the unperturbed Hamiltonian plus the perturbation, and go ahead and collect terms of order lambda 0, lambda to the 0th power, lambda to the 1st power, and lambda to the 2nd power. And that will give us our first order. Well, the 0th order term better give us back the original Schrodinger equation for the unperturbed state, and we'll find that's the case. The first order term will give us the first order corrections, and the second order terms will give us the second order corrections. And of course, you could do this to 3rd or 4th or nth order just by carrying out more terms in the power series. So, the Schrodinger equation becomes, the real Hamiltonian is H naught plus lambda H prime. This will operate on the real wave function, which we've now power series expanded, as psi n naught plus lambda psi n 1 plus lambda squared psi n 2. And in principle, we could carry through as many terms as you want. This will be equal to the new stationary state energies, which we've power series expanded in terms of the known unperturbed stationary state energies, En naught plus lambda En 1 plus lambda squared En 2. Of course, you could carry through higher order terms if you're interested in them. This will now be multiplied with the new stationary state wave functions, which are going to expand in the same way, psi n naught plus lambda psi n 1 plus lambda squared psi n 2, etc. And what we want to do is collect terms of order lambda to the zeroth power. It's the only term which is of order lambda to the zeroth power is h naught psi n naught equal to en naught psi n naught. So h naught psi n naught is equal to en naught psi n naught. And of course, we already knew that. That's the unperturbed stationary state solution to the Schrodinger equation. If we were to expand it now or collect terms of order lambda to the first, the terms that will that come out will be h naught psi n 1 plus h prime psi n naught is equal to en 1 psi n naught plus en naught psi n 1. This equation here, we know everything except en 1 and psi n 1. And so presumably this equation could be solved for en 1 and psi n 1. And as a result, this will give us the first order correction. It's probably not obvious yet how this would be solved, but we'll do that next time. Similarly, we could collect terms of order lambda squared, and those terms will be h naught psi n 2 plus h 1 psi n 1 is equal to en naught psi n 2 plus en 1 psi n 1 plus en 2 psi n naught. And presumably this equation will give us the second order correction. And so that's what we'll do next time, is we'll consider how we utilize this equation and that equation to calculate the first and second order corrections, not only to the stationary state energies, but also the stationary state wave functions. Furthermore, you'll notice here that we're considering all of the higher order energies, not just the ground state energy. This is one of the powers of perturbation theory, is that it finds the corrections to all the energies, not just the ground state, whereas in variational principle, we are limited to the ground state energy. So this is in many ways more powerful than variational principle, but it is a little bit more complicated, so there's a trade-off there. We'll continue and complete the analysis tomorrow, and then we'll be just reviewing next week for the exam. All right, thanks.
MSE 405.